This is the Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue. With Jonathan Hutton, Chad Withrow, and Paul Kuharski.
An hour in, second hour begins. Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue with Paul Kuharski in Brentwood. Jonathan Hutton with you here in Murfreesboro. David Reed is the chairman of the board, making the show happen for us in Nashville. Coming up in 15 minutes, Nashville history with David Ewing. It's been a great discussion with him each week. We just finished up the Ryman history dating back to the 1800s. We stay in the 1800s for the start of this next business we'll discuss, Hatch Show Print Shop. And we will get all the details on Hatch Show Prints. That's coming up at 11:15. Love having David on. At noon today, our Nashville Sports Retrospective focuses on the 1999 season of Javon Kearse, the rookie season for the Freak. Javon will join us, and then Jim Washburn will join us. Javon's defensive line coach. It was also Wash's first year here in Music City for the Tennessee Titans as the D-line coach. Looking forward to that hour. It's going to be a lot of fun. And then John McClain with the latest NFL headlines. The NFL owners are having their NFL owners meeting. It's virtual. That's going on today. And we discussed in the first hour the Rooney Rule, and they're considering some adjustments to that. We'll dig in a little bit deeper on all that with John McClain. That's today at 1 o'clock. Paul, I was just scanning through the schedule beyond the surface-level details of opponent and the history between each opponent and all of that. And a couple of things stand out to me when the schedule was first announced. And right off the bat, they have to get off to a strong start. You know, that they have not done that the last two seasons. And the goal that Vrabel said right after the season was, look, the one difference that I would change in what we did this postseason, the only thing I need different is to host a game. Because that gauntlet of road games catches up to you. And it did in Kansas City. Now, I'm not going to sit here and argue that the Chiefs wouldn't have won that game in a rematch at Nissan Stadium. It was the best game in the regular season, 35-32 here in Nashville. But if that's the goal, they have to watch out for the margin for error late in the year. And to do that, they have to win those critical AFC matchups early. Five of the first six games of the season are AFC matchups. Four of those five are at home, and they have a chance to really do something with their record before their break. If they beat Houston going into the bye week and they tack on some wins at home, they're on a roll as they begin the second half of that season. And AFC South matters. We hate the fact that the Colts play the Titans twice within, I think, 17 days, but they would not be, you know, white-knuckling the schedule in December like they have had to do. They've had success doing it to get to 9-7 and to get in the postseason last year, but they have to take care of those AFC matchups early. We saw that with the tiebreakers scenarios that we went through in Week 17 back in December.
Yeah, home early is important, and it's not easy. You know, that's the thing. You could argue that the road is a little bit easier. I mean, Denver is not that tough. I'm not as high on Minnesota as a lot of people. Cincinnati is a must win. Baltimore is going to be a tough one. They're going to have revenge on their mind. At Indianapolis, we know what you've got there. At Jacksonville, Green Bay, I think probably falls back a little bit, though that's a big one. At Houston at the end of the season, that's not nearly, to me, as tough as the home schedule. So you've got this thing where you've got to win at home, and the home games feel tougher to me than the road games. And then you've got them packed in. The premium home games come in a tight bunch there. Pittsburgh, Buffalo, and Chicago. Those are the games that are more expensive as individual games. And they come in a span. Pittsburgh and Buffalo are back-to-back, and Chicago comes again in short order. I don't really feel good about the schedule. I don't like the way it's top heavy home and rode heavy late. And I hate, you know, this is a huge pet peeve of mine. I think it's got to be abolished by the league. But you can't have Titans Colts in what may determine the division twice in 17 days. You've got to space out these division games by at least 5 or 6 weeks. You're two different teams at different stages of the season in terms of development, in terms of injuries. And when you see each other twice in such short order, I think it's just a disservice to the teams, to the leagues, to the division competition. I hate that above all else.
I do too. And it doesn't happen as often as it may be portrayed that it does. It
seems to happen to the Titans every year that they have a quick rematch with somebody in the division.
Well, so Warren Sharp, who we should have on later this week, if you want, we can send him a text on this. Fascinating numbers when it comes to the entire NFL schedule. Teams played each other twice in 3 weeks, just 23 times since the year 2000. So not that often. One and a half times a year on average, yeah. You know? So not as much. Although, yeah, we've seen it happen with the Titans just last year with Houston. The record in the rematch game of those matchups is 7-16. So the team that wins the first matchup only won the second matchup 7 times.
It's almost always a split, which I think that doesn't surprise me. Does that surprise you?
Kind of.
Division matchups lean towards splits to me, generally anyway.
I'm not surprised. It kind of surprises me because I think you're catching the one argument and why you want it spread out is the season drama plays itself out in different waves for different teams. And you think eventually the injuries even themselves out or whatever. And to me, you would catch a team during this stretch going through a big injury phase where you have two receivers down with an ankle and a hammy or something, and you catch them at the right time and the other team takes advantage. That's clearly not what's happening.
Yeah.
But from 23-0 to 7-16. Anyway, that happened 23 times since the year 2000. It's happening 5 times this year. Atlanta in New Orleans, Atlanta in Tampa Bay, Indy in Tennessee, Indy and Houston. The Colts have it twice. And then Miami and the Jets. Miami and the New York Jets will play back-to-back games. The only thing separating them is a bye week. So,
and it's more ridiculous this year because they're not planning around concerts. They're not planning around other events in these stadiums because there are none. There's nothing else on the docket. So one thing that might have forced some of these things and made them inevitable in the scheduling is gone. So there's no reason. Now, I understand it's complicated, but they make it like it's the most complicated thing in the world. They could avoid these, and they don't. It's not a priority for them, and it should be. Here's another thing you're mentioning, Warren Sharp.
Yep.
I hate strength of schedule, and largely because of him, but strength of schedule based on last year's results is dumb. Teams change very much year to year. Last year's winning percentage for, say, Tampa Bay and New England isn't that relevant to me. And it makes more sense. I mean, he's got it broken down in all different ways. But one very smart way of looking at it is based on Las Vegas predicted win totals. So the Titans have the second easiest strength of schedule based on Vegas predicted win totals. Now, that's a little heavily weighted because they play the Jaguars twice, and the Jaguars are predicted to be one of the worst teams in the league, and the Bengals. So the Jaguars' total is 4.6. The Bengals is 5.4. And the only really big number they have is the Ravens at 11.5. The Steelers, Vikings, and Bills are the only ones at 9 or above outside of that. But I think that's a reasonable way to look at it. He's also got it, and I wrote this last week, he's also got it based on, you know, DVOA from last year, which has a more, he says is a more likely thing to carry over than last year's win totals, you know, or units effectiveness on these metrics. But we should do away with looking at last year's win totals, last year's winning percentage, as a factor in the difficulty of this year's schedule. Teams change a lot from year to year.
And, you know, just looking a little bit layer deeper on the schedule, the Titans face seven teams that finished in the top 10 defensively. But the good news is on that, they don't face them to begin the year. Take that back. Denver was a top 10 finisher. Baltimore, Green Bay, Minnesota, Buffalo, Chicago, Pittsburgh, Denver, in no particular order. Those are the top 10, seven of the top 10 defenses. Four of the seven defenses are on the road that they'll face. Baltimore, Denver, Green Bay, and Minnesota. So I'm not looking at win total there, just looking at strictly defense, because there were some putrid offenses with those teams. There's the combo that you look out for.
And one thing that could happen here schedule-wise that would change some things up, you know, those first four could get lopped off and put at the end, which would change the home and away thing a little bit. You know, then they would finish at Denver, Jacksonville, at Minnesota, Pittsburgh, which would change the balance of things a little bit if they were to play into January and the season were to be pushed back. Also, that Jacksonville game week two, everybody's got the same bye week that plays in week two. Week two could easily become week, two, four, six, seven.
Yeah.
And so that game could easily be moved to week seven. So if they moved week one to the end and moved week two to week seven, you know, then they could open conceivably at Minnesota with what is now week three. There's just something about the schedule that doesn't feel great to me.
There's those other aspects we can hit on, numbers within the schedule. And I have details on the opponents and who they face coming off certain games. The one nugget I'll throw out, Paul, the Titans do not face a team coming off a bye week this year or a mini bye. They do not face a team coming off a bye week or a Thursday night football game. So that is a small advantage with their schedule. But again, there's other details with that we can hit later.
I don't know if you agree with this. I think that the Monday night game to start is kind of a faux primetime game. There aren't as many eyes on that late Monday night game as people believe. That's kind of a hidden primetime game. Much of the country is asleep for at least the second half of that game, if not the whole thing. Then you've got a late return and a short week going into Jacksonville. That there's not a lot of prestige to me in that hole. That's kind of a pain in the butt spot.
There is prestige with Hat Show Print Shop. One of our favorite things about our collections in Nashville. Paul's got his collection in his office. I've yet to hang mine. Claire's got a bunch of Hat Show prints from the Ryman as well. The history behind Hat Show Print Shop with David Ewing next. Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue on 104.5 The Zone. Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue on 104.5 The Zone. So glad you're with us on this Tuesday edition. Javon Kearse and Jim Washburn joining us in the noon hour, our Nashville sports retrospective focusing on the 99 season, the rookie season for the Freak. We all love Nashville and the great stories behind our city, and historian David Ewing provides the best of those. We're lucky to have him on Tuesdays for Nashville History in 30 Minutes. We've just wrapped up the three-part series on Ryman Auditorium, which you can listen to on our podcast page, among other conversations. Midday180.com is where you can find those. And today we discuss a Nashville staple, as Paul would say, a delight, Hat Show Print Company. David, how are you? Good morning.
Wonderful, Hutton. Great to be with you and talk about one of my favorite places in Nashville, Hat Show Print, where I was my first job in Nashville. I worked there for a few years when I was a teenager.
What did you do?
It would be nice to say I made some great posters of rock and roll acts or country music stars, but I cleaned off. After a poster was done, I would clean the ink off the wooden letters and put them back in the tray. So I guess did a little bit of preserving. So yeah. Those same letters are the great letters that are being printed today that Paul has in the background of his office there on his wall. Most of the letters from Hatcho Print are from the 19th century, these great wooden letters.
That's an important piece of the process. I wouldn't downgrade your thing.
Yeah.
But behind me here, I have Kings of Leon, Mark Knopfler, PK Unleashed, my own posters, which I invested big money in, and I have a lot of them sitting. It was a failed purchase, Hutton, because I made it.
It was?
Pickers Vodka, and Pickers Vodka is no longer part of my deal, sadly. I have a U.S. versus Paraguay soccer match from LP Field. Coldplay, the first game at the new First Tennessee ballpark. Neil Young, Springsteen, Mumford & Sons, Rolling Stones, who are going to play tomorrow night. I heard that one's off. And the Women's Final Four lining my office. David Gray, Ray LaMontagne, one on my floor, and several others upstairs that didn't make the cut from my office.
Hatcho Print, David, is the oldest show business printing company in the world. Do you view it as a working museum in some ways?
It is totally a working museum, and that's the beauty of Hatcho Print and the Ryman. You could have just had either one of those be a museum, and you could look at the old posters, and you could look at the old letters, and you could look at the old printing press, but they still use those same block letters and print posters all the time. Now, Hatcho Print, of course, because of the virus, is temporarily closed from in their new home of the Country Music Hall of Fame, but when the Hall of Fame gets back up and running, they'll be back up and running too and printing some posters, even though a lot of the events that I'm sure they were printing posters for have been postponed themselves. Hatch always has kind of an interesting backlog of orders. And of course, the Grand Ole Opry, the circle has not been broken. They're performing every week. And so Hatch has had a long affiliation with the Grand Ole Opry, actually going back to 1939. Even before the Opry was at the Ryman, they started to print posters for the Grand Ole Opry.
So Reverend Tom Ryman, we've discussed that at length over the last 3 weeks, the name behind Ryman Auditorium and the Tabernacle. Hatcho Print Company formed from two sons of a reverend. Is that right?
Yes. Reverend William T. Hatch moved to Nashville in 1875. He was in the religious publishing area, and then he finally started his own newspaper, business newspaper, in 1879. Sadly, that office burned, and then he died the next year. But his sons, Charles and Herbert, opened up their own printing business in 1879 in the Printer's Alley area where the Nashville Banner Building was. They worked out of that banner building for many, many years before they had their own separate location.
So they started there, and the original equipment, all of that is still intact today. That business you just mentioned, is that a replica of what they tried to put together at the Country Music Hall of Fame?
Well, it's interesting. The Hatcho Print has moved around a lot over in the 19th century. The area of 5th and Church Street, where the 5th Third building is today, there was something behind there kind of running parallel to the arcade called Hatch Alley, and they had a location there. The most famous home of Hatcho Print before their current home is where the Batman building is on 4th Avenue, kind of right across from the Ryman Auditorium. The Hatches built that building just for their print shop. It was there from 1924 to 1992 when they moved to Broadway. And that's the building I used to work in. And it's interesting, when I walked in the building that's at the Country Music Hall of Fame, the new press, I talked to my friend Jim Sherarden, who was a longtime manager of Hatch. And I told him it reminded me of the 4th Avenue location. And he said that that was the biggest compliment, because I was one of the few people that remembered that location as well as the current one.
How long was it on Broadway? Because that's where I discovered it. And it felt like a place, and I knew it was a long time institution, so it felt like a place that had been there forever. I presume a place like that, and I imagine a lot of people who came to town presume that had been there forever. Like a yeah. place like that wouldn't have been as mobile as it turned out to be. That's why I was so surprised when it moved to the Country Music Hall of Fame thing. I was like, this a place like this doesn't move. A place like this, people move to it.
Well, Paul, I'm actually very happy it's in the Country Music Hall of Fame. They moved to an old furniture store, the Mayfield Furniture Store on Lower Broadway in 1992. And the architect, Gary Everton, who also did the Pinnacle Building here in this town, basically was told by Bill Ivey, the head of the Hall of Fame, to basically make this building look like it was authentic. So they basically stripped the building down to the wooden floors and the bare walls and the 16-foot ceilings and put all this great, you know, equipment, these old presses, the printing blocks. And so it really looked authentic. And this was kind of before It's City. I was always worried that, you know, someone would vandalize the building or one of those buildings would catch on fire and the whole block would be burned down and you would lose, you know, over 100 years of history and blocks and carving. So Hatch is a museum itself. It belongs in a museum, but it's a working company and they're still cranking out posters.
So how long were they on Broadway?
They were on Broadway from 92 to 2013. When they moved inside the fairly new built Country Music Hall of Fame.
Historian David Ewing with us. Coming up, we'll discuss some of the contracts they've had over the years. They worked out a deal, I believe, with the Grand Ole Opry, how they were introduced to that route whenever the Grand Ole Opry was at War Memorial at the time, David?
Yes.
We'll set that story up. And also, we'll go way back in history to the very first print job that they had and the history behind that. And the other note I want you to tell the story behind is their phone number, which I think will be very fascinating for people today in 2020, or if you've had a cell phone, for instance. Well, more with David Ewing coming up. Also, 2 degrees of separation. David Reed will try to stump David Ewing next. Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue, 104.5 The Zone. David Ewing with us on the Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue. You can search the podcast for David's chats about Lower Broadway, Printer's Alley, and the Ryman. Midday180.com, the website, 1045thezone.com. David Ewing, a ninth-generation Nashvillian. He's one of the best historians when it comes to the city of Nashville and beyond for our area. Check out his website, NashvilleHistoryOnTour.com. His Instagram is a must-follow. Are we close to 10,000? When we started this,
we're
at
probably
8.
Like 200 away from 10,000. Thanks to
at
you all.
The Nashville I Wish I Knew. At The Nashville I Wish I Knew you can follow him.
And if you go to my Instagram, The Nashville I Wish I Knew, I've linked the Hat Show Print Instagram, which is a great Instagram to follow. And my friend Jim Sherarden, who was a longtime manager of Hatch and retired a few years ago, his Instagram's there and just unbelievable art that he still creates.
Tell us the phone number for Hat Show Print in the early days.
In the early days, we didn't have area codes or 7-digit numbers. We had just 3-digit numbers, and it was 805. And it's interesting as Hatch has moved around all the locations, including the Country Music Hall of Fame, they kept the 805 in their number. So today it's 615-256-2805 is Hatch's number. So that's another piece of history that Hatch has maintained.
Their very first handbill that they put together was for a reverend. All of these stories over the last few weeks tie back to church and a reverend, it seems. But it was Reverend Henry Ward Beecher. I'll let you connect the dots there. But that was the first actual job that they were paid to do.
Yes, and Jim and Hatch recreated this recently. It was a lecture, and back then in the 19th century, there were a lot of lectures as well as concerts, and so he hired the Hatch brothers to do it, and they did a recreation of this poster from 1879 during their 120th anniversary. So Reverend Henry Ward Beecher, of course, was a very famous person in the country, abolition and a lot of other things. And so it's interesting that their very first poster was kind of an iconic institution. Later, a few years ago, there was an anniversary, 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, and the U.S. Post Office made a stamp, and they got Hat Show Print to design the Emancipation Proclamation anniversary stamp.
The old woodblock type and the letterpress, I describe it as if you go to a concert and you leave with a Hat Show Print, it's been you were Nashville notarized. That show was
yeah,
Nashville
that's
notarized.
A great way to put it.
And I'm curious, when did it become national? Do they have national jobs, print jobs, or was this just a local deal where if you were in Tennessee, you would see these posters on fence posts and telephone poles and on, you know, doors as you went into an establishment?
They always had national jobs. Movie theater chains like the Bijou chain here in town, the Knickerbocker and the Princess Theater, Elvis Presley, Hank Williams, you know, everyone ordered their posters from Hatch. It's funny, people like Hank Williams and Patsy Cline actually picked up their posters themselves, that they would go in the shop and pick them up. And, you know, there's a story that's in Jim Sherarden's first book on Hat Show Print that talks about Hank Williams picking his posters up, you know, going down to Louisiana to get married. And when he picks up his bride, he sits in the back seat on the freshly printed posters, and his white suit has the ink of Hatch, and you could see all the acts that are performing with Hank Williams on that. So kind of ruined his wedding suit, but, you know, Hank liked to pick up his own posters.
How did their relationship with the Ryman come about? Seems like 9 out of 10 shows I've been to there, the artist has signed up for the Ryman poster deal. It's always a disappointment when he or she doesn't sell that unique poster for that unique Nashville show.
Yeah, I think a Nashville bucket list for any artist is to have a Hat Show Print and to play at the Ryman. Gaylord Entertainment bought a Hat Show Print in the 80s when it was probably just going to close and go away. They were going to take, or they took some of the presses out to Opryland to print them and have posters out there. It didn't go over so well, so they decided to donate it to the Country Music Hall of Fame. Gaylord, of course, bought the Opryland properties during that time, too. So there's always been a tight bond with Hat Show Print and the Grand Ole Opry and the Ryman. That 4th Avenue location, which was where the Batman building is today, that was right across the street from the Ryman. So it was very easy for people to have their posters done. And today, as you said, whether it be Mumford & Sons or the Foo Fighters or, you know, all these great acts that book at the Ryman, there's usually a Hat Show Print. And if you don't go to the merch table like an hour before the show and buy it, you know, it's usually gone by the time the curtains goes up, and you could buy it on eBay later, maybe for a couple $100. These are in such demand.
David Ewing with us. Each week we have 2 degrees of separation with David Ewing. And this week, Chad's on furlough, so David Reed steps in trying to stump David Ewing, trying to connect an historical place or a historical person or thing, a moment, to Nashville. Reed, what do you have?
So this week we're going to go with a particular organization, and this was sparked by a podcast that I recently listened to called Winds of Change. I won't spoil it for you, but it involves a song, a band, and a certain intelligence organization within the United States. So I'm wanting to see if David can connect for us either the CIA or the FBI to Nashville's history.
Okay. The FBI. The FBI was run by J. Edgar Hoover, and very famously, the building is named after J. Edgar Hoover. I remember interviewing the late John Siegenthaler about Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy was one of his close friends, and John was driving Bobby around to interview with senators to basically see if they supported him being Attorney General of the United States, because it was controversial because he was the brother of the incoming president. And John Siegenthaler told me that they would drive up and he'd hop out, and Bobby Kennedy would hop out of the car and and talk to a senator, and he'd be all happy and come back, and his face was just sunken because none of the senators thought it was a good idea. But they drove to the FBI building to see J. Edgar Hoover, and Hoover actually thought it was a good idea that Bobby Kennedy be the attorney general. And so, you know, despite initial problems with that, it turned out that we have the attorney general of the United States being close friends with John Siegenthaler and their trip to see J. Edgar Hoover.
A final hat show thought here. They were exposed maybe in a new way to a lot of the country through the NFL draft, which wisely they chose to display one for each team. They had the AFC and the NFC on each side of the stage. I was snapping pictures like crazy to get art for my site, and it wasn't their intention to sell them until there was huge demand for them. I'm surprised it wasn't their intention to sell them. It was a money-making jackpot there. Ultimately, they did sell them to great demand, but certainly great exposure for your hat show, and not in the music venue, but in the sporting venue.
I asked my friend and manager of Hat Show Print today, Selene Aubrey, about that they printed up, the NFL had them print up posters for every team, and they were just going to be for the super fans that, you know, get to be on the stage and all of this. And then they did not know that the NFL would blow them up, you know, electronically, and there'd be this large part of our draft stage. She reminded me that in 2016, the Goo Goo Dolls printed up every single Hat Show Print poster from all of their tour dates in 2016, which was 48 all over the country. And so that was also kind of how Hat Show Print went national. But there's a wonderful new book out on Hat Show Print that Jim Sheridan and Selene wrote. It's $15, which is basically, it's a full color paperback book with all sorts of photos and of your favorite Hat Show prints, from Keith Urban to Elvis to Garth Brooks to Trisha Yearwood. And it's a great gift. And like I said, for the cost of one of their Hat Show Print replicas in the gift shop, you can buy this. You could also actually go online while they're closed during this pandemic. But it's always good to support artists and creative people.
David Ewing. Follow him on Instagram at the Nashville I Wish I Knew. Go ahead, David.
The last story I want to tell you, if you walk into Hatch, you have all these creative people working there. And I asked Jim, how did this start? It really started 29 years ago. There's a private school here in Nashville called Harpeth Hall that they have a winterim program, an intern program for their students. And Harpeth Hall students started interning at Hatch Show Print. And Jim would go across the country and talk about letterpress printing and Hat Show Print. And as he said, he went to every single city twice on the back of the Southwest Airlines napkin. And he would also get asked about, how do I get to work for this great company? And, you know, they set up an intern program, which they still have. So today we have some of the most creative people interning at Hatch for a period of time, and then they'll take this skill back to their hometown and keep this kind of letterpress legacy alive, as Hatch has done for, you know, since 1879.
We love them, that's for sure. David, thank you so much, man. This is always a real treat to have you on, and it's cool to learn more about our city.
A lot of fun.
Thank you. See you all soon.
Yep. David Ewing has been our guest. Again, follow him on Instagram. A great follow. If you like going back in time and seeing what Broadway looked like, for instance, in the early 1900s, or the area where Nissan Stadium now sits, what that was in the late 1800s as they float logs to all these lumber mills down the Cumberland River. He's got photos and artifacts and all kinds of things at the Nashville I Wish I Knew on Instagram. Some news for the NHL, for the countries involved, and a new agreement that's in place between the United States and Canada, and how that affects the Predators. Next, Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue, 104.5 The Zone. Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue. Coming up as we begin the second half of the show at noon, Javon Kearse on the show, our Nashville sports retrospective. The Freak will join us. We'll reminisce about his rookie season from 1999. And then Jim Washburn will also be on the show during the noon hour. Really looking forward to that. We're looking forward to having sports back. and local sports for sure. Hopefully the Titans get going on time. MLS, we had Gary Smith on yesterday and their discussions through MLS and Nashville SC about having a tournament in Orlando, round robin style, which would be cool to see if they could pull it off as they try to get their season back up and running. We've heard things through the NBA and, of course, the NHL with players scattered all over the globe. David Poyle, who will join us later this week, will certainly get into this topic. But CTV News, one of the news agencies in Canada, they have a report stating, Paul, that an agreement has been reached between Canada and the United States to keep the border closed to all non-essential travel for at least another month. And, of course, this is today. So if you fast forward a month, it would mean that the NHL could begin travel in July. And some would say that's perfectly fine for them to be able to get their season in and then push back the start of the next season, for instance. But for all of the speculation that they may be able to get things going at some point in the next 30 days, based on this, they're not going to be able to travel across the Canadian border and vice versa, where a lot of players currently are. A lot of Canadians are in Canada that play for teams across the United States. And as Poyle has told us, he has a handful of players that are in Switzerland, Sweden, and Finland and different places. So with all that in mind, they're at least waiting another month to even return to a sheet of ice per team to get things going.
Yeah, it's a big complication for them that may slow things down more for them than for others. Baseball-wise, it's pretty much been presumed that the Blue Jays would not be playing in Toronto at the start of things if they were on their the planned calendar, that they might be playing at their Florida spring training home.
I want to just throw this in there. I think the key phrasing in this report is non-essential personnel travel. With all of the leaders from, you know, the president on down to governors from state to state, from New York to Texas, they're all saying, we want sports back. You could argue they're essential, and they probably would, to get the economy back and to actually have some things going within their state. So maybe they're deemed essential travel for this.
Maybe. I'm so uncomfortable with the way we use some words now. I mean, essential to something, sure. Essential in the true meaning of essential, you know, absolutely. What's essential now? Grocery store people.
There are a ton of things that are essential. There's still construction going on in my neighborhood right now.
Right. But is that even essential? You know?
Right. So if you can throw it around, you can throw it around for anything. House,
it's too liberally being thrown around. I mean, sports are not essential. We could make subsets of essential.
That's not what Governor Cuomo and everyone else are saying right now. They're saying sports are essential. They're holding press conferences about it now. Florida and Texas are saying, if you can't play in your state, come here. Let's go, which is great news. I mean, I think they're saying we have to give some lifeblood to some normalcy. And that's what sports would do.
Well, I want some normalcy. But, I mean, if Toronto has to play in Florida, that's fine by me. That's not a
– Yeah, but I don't
have to see them in the Rogers Center.
They can go to Detroit, you know. They don't have to go to Florida. But the idea being, is there a workaround there for travel? If there is, maybe they can get going earlier. But that's the direction we're headed. It's just the agreement between the two countries now with the travel restrictions remain in place for another month. That's the only real news out there. There is news for the Triple Crown. We know that the Kentucky Derby was rescheduled. But now the first leg of the Triple Crown will be when, Paul?
It will be the Belmont Stakes in front of no fans. And so things go backwards. Saturday, June 20th, without spectators in attendance, the 152nd Belmont Stakes, the New York Racing Authority or whatever the governing body is, has announced that.
We're looking at a potential Triple Crown winner at the Kentucky Derby.
I guess so. Yeah, that would be
something. That's cool.
Yeah, you certainly root like hell for it to happen so that we could see it go backwards.
Yes.
Are they running, though? I haven't paid any attention to the racing. So is the Kentucky Derby planning on running in the late fall?
Yes. I mean, they held a race there this weekend, I believe.
Yeah.
Or races without fans that you could certainly wager on online. Hey, coming up in the noon hour, the Nashville Sports Retrospective. And we take a look back when we return of Javon Kearse's rookie season. The freak, Javon Kearse, joins us next on that memorable rookie season with 14 and a half sacks, which is the rookie record in the NFL. Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue. This is 104.5 The Zone.